Okay, welcome. So I'd like to start by giving credit to my co-authors, particularly Shanley Ellum, who is originally from McGill, and she actually just told me that she has met her husband in this very building at a presentation, so maybe pay close attention to your neighbors. So we're interested in cross-linguistic structural priming. Structural priming is a phenomenon that has been around in experimental psycholinguistics for more than 30 years. And it refers to the fact that when people have to produce a sentence, they tend to repeat structures they have encountered shortly before. So imagine, this is a classical study, imagine you have to describe this picture. Basically, it displays an event for which you need a ditransitive structure, and you can either use a double object or a prepositional object to describe this picture. And it has been shown that when people are asked to do this, they are influenced by structures they have encountered shortly before. So if you have shortly before read or perceived a double object structure, then that increases the chance that you use a double object structure to describe the picture. And if you've encountered a prepositional object shortly before, then that increases the chance that you use a prepositional object to describe this picture. So what is actually quite interesting in this case is the fact that this also works across languages. So say you have to describe this picture in French, and you have shortly before encountered an English sentence, which includes either a prepositional object or a double object, then the priming effect also occurs. And is actually, numerically speaking, not even weaker than within languages. So in the past 10 years, people have done quite a bit of research on cross-linguistic structural priming. We know that it works for different types of alternations, so not only for prepositional objects and double objects, but also for something like active-passive or for relative clause attachment. It has also been shown that it works for a variety of different language pairs, that it works both from L1 to L2 and from L2 to L1, and that it works for a variety of different experimental paradigms. And as a result of that, people have come up with accounts which try to link this experimental research with natural dialogue. So if you read work from, say, Pickering and Garrett, they assume that these priming effects play a huge role in dialogue, in the sense that people automatically establish some sort of alignment by priming each other and using the same structures to refer to similar things, and thereby making sure that these are structures that the other person understands. However, there's a big difference between experimental research, in the sense we do this, where we typically use the simplest structures that we possibly can use, and natural dialogue. While ditransitive structures are, as such, very frequent in natural dialogue as well, so when you talk to a person and you use a ditransitive structure, it's quite possible that he has used a ditransitive structure shortly before as well. The big difference is that the surrounding structural information, so the structure in which this prepositional object or double object is embedded, often differs. So, for example, somebody might ask a question and you give an answer. Or you encounter a prepositional object as embedded in a subordinate clause, and subsequently you produce a main clause. And the question is, how does that influence the structural priming effect? So what happens when the priming structure itself, say the prepositional double object, is there in both prime and target, but the stuff around it differs? So I should say that for within English priming, this has already been done. So Brannigan and colleagues did a study on this where they manipulated the level of embedding on which the prime structure, in which the prime structure was embedded. And found that priming pretty much occurs irrespective of the surrounding structural context. So no matter whether the prime is in a subordinate clause or in main clause, and no matter whether this level of embedding is the same across prime and target, you always get structural priming. It is somewhat boosted when it's on the same level, but it occurs irrespective of the surrounding information. Now, there is one sort of slight problem with this study in the sense that they manipulated this across experiments. So they did one experiment with main clause to main clause priming, one experiment with subclause to main clause priming, and then they compared their results across experiments. And we'd like to, so we thought it might be a good idea to replicate this and to see whether we get the same effects when we manipulate this as conditions within the same experiment. Also, this is a study in English, and you might say that in English, main clause or subordinate clause doesn't really play a role. When you have a simple, straightforward, ditransitive structure, you could just put something like Peter said that in front of it, and nothing would change. And that's when we came up with the idea to do this in German, because in German, main versus subordinate clause actually has quite severe word order consequences, in the sense that German, as we have heard before, is SVO in main clauses, but is verb final in subordinate clauses. So you cannot just put something like Peter said that in front of the sentence and turn it into a subordinate clause. When you do that, the verb actually moves to the end. And you might say that for a language with such a property, the level of embedding on which the prime structure occurs might play a considerably more severe role in priming. So basically, we had a pretty simple design where people get a ditransitive sentence that is exactly the same, except for the fact that one version of it is a prepositional object, the other is a double object. And this prime structure is either a main clause or embedded in a subordinate clause. People get one of these primes. The task is actually very simple. People are told, okay, you're going to see a few sentences on the computer screen. If it's a complete sentence, then just read it out aloud. And if it's a sentence fragment, then read out aloud what's already there and complete it in a grammatically correct way. So people get one of these primes, and then they get a target fragment and have to complete it. And what we measure is which structure people use to complete this. So basically, what we manipulate in this experiment is the type of prime. It's either a prepositional object or a double object, and whether prime and target are both main clauses or both subordinate clauses. So that's our same clause type in prime and target condition, or whether clause types differ between prime and target. So within each condition, there are 50% main clause, and 50% subclause, subclause items. We did this because we can later do a post-hoc analysis and see whether main clause priming differs from subclause, subclause priming. So if it's really the case that only the prepositional object or double object itself matters, then we should get priming across the board in all conditions. So the surrounding structural context or the level of embedding shouldn't matter at all. But it might be that this structural context plays a role, and then we should get an interaction in the sense that priming is stronger when prime and target are of the same clause type. So these are native speakers of German. It's an experiment within German, 24 item sets, and we added quite a few fillers to conceal the idea behind the experiment. And this is basically what we get. So what you see here is the proportions of prepositional object completions by condition. So you can see on the left that when clause type is the same in prime and target, people produce more prepositional objects when they are primed by a prepositional object than in a case where they've been primed by a double object. And this is actually also the same when clause type differs between prime and target, but you can see that the difference on the left-hand side is numerically much larger than the difference on the right-hand side, and we also get this interaction significant. In this respect, these results are exactly the same as what Brannigan and colleagues found for within English priming. They get priming across the board, but it's stronger when prime and target share the same level of embedding. As I said, we can do a post-hoc analysis to split this up. What we see here is that we get about a 20% priming effect for main clause to main clause priming, also a 20% priming effect for subclause to subclause priming, and numerically weaker but still significant priming effects for main clause to subclause and subclause to main clause priming. Now, until now, you might ask, why the hell is this guy here? Because this has nothing to do with multilingualism. The point is that at the moment, until now, I've talked about English, which is a language where level of embedding doesn't have any word order consequences, and German, which is a language where level of embedding has serious word order consequences. And what happens if you couple these two languages up and do a cross-linguistic priming experiment? Now, we've seen here that word order as such in within language priming apparently doesn't really play a role. We get the same effects no matter whether we do a within English or within German priming experiment. But maybe that's different if you put people in a code-switching situation and look at cross-linguistic priming effects. So we did exactly the same thing again, except for the fact that we translated these little target fragments into English. The task is still exactly the same in the sense that people get told, okay, you're going to get either a German or an English sentence on the screen. If it's a complete sentence, read it out aloud. If it's a fragment, complete it in a grammatically correct way. And because of issues of statistical power, we tried to split this up into two experiments. So in one experiment, we had priming from main clause to main clause and from subclause to subclause. And in the other experiment, we had the other two conditions. So remember, in the within German priming experiment, we got priming for both of these conditions. So if cross-linguistic priming is the same, we shouldn't find anything different here. But actually, what we do get is a rather strikingly different pattern. So as long as the prime and the target are both main clauses, we get a priming effect that is significant and that is numerically similar to what we found in the within German priming experiment. But if for priming from subclause to subclause, we suddenly don't get any priming at all anymore. And as a result, we actually get a statistically significant interaction between these conditions. So while subclauses don't really matter in within language priming, they suddenly entirely destroy the priming effect in cross-linguistic priming. And this is pretty much the experiment containing the other two conditions. And it gets even weirder. In this experiment, we don't get any priming effect for any of the two conditions. So no matter whether it's priming from main clauses to subordinate clauses or from subordinate clauses to main clauses, suddenly the priming effect is entirely gone. For cross-linguistic priming, you only get it from main clauses to main clauses. So what do we make of this? So unlike for within language priming, cross-linguistic priming apparently requires similarity between prime and target with regard to both level of embedding. We only get it when the prime and target are embedded on the same level. And it also requires similarity on the level of word order. Because take into account that if you look at the condition where people get a German main clause prime and an English subordinate clause target, word order is actually the same across these, because German main clauses are SVO and English subordinate clauses are also SVO. So if it was just about word order, we should have really found priming there, but there's nothing there at all. So what we think is going on is that because this is a code-switching situation, the amount of similarity between prime and target needs to be higher with regard to these factors which don't play much of a role in within-language priming. And I think this is quite important because traditionally people have looked at cross-linguistic and within-language priming in terms of the same phenomenon, because you get the same effects. They are actually equally large, no matter whether you do within-language or cross-linguistic priming. So presumably what's behind it is the same phenomenon. But maybe that's not the case, because we can show here that a factor such as level of embedding has rather drastically different consequences for within-language and cross-linguistic priming. So that's it. Hope you enjoyed it. And I'm happy to answer your questions.
I just have a suggestion. This is reminiscent of, I don't know if you're familiar with Poplack's famous article, sometimes I start a sentence in Spanish y termino en español, where she talks about the equivalence constraint, which is one of the basic constraints for code switching. So I think you have experimental evidence to support that. And and it should be cited somewhere in this study. I think this shows it very clearly.
Okay.
Okay? Mm-hmm.
Hi, that's very interesting work. I was just wondering, though, why you decided to do this in a code-switching context, because your participants are very unlikely to be regular code-switchers between German main clauses and English embedded clauses, and I was wondering whether the null effect might be due to the fact that this population is known not to code-switch in these situations, and if so, would you think that you could have gotten the same effect that Brannigan et al. Found for English for L2 English in these participants, if you just presented the same experiment in English to these German participants, so it would have been L2 only.
Oh, okay. So,
or did I misunderstand something?
I would basically treat that as a suggestion. So, yeah, I mean, in the sense that if you just look at the design, we have tested priming within German, and we have tested priming from German to English. So you could actually say that this is some sort of incomplete design, that in the sense that you should also test priming within English, and you should also test priming from English to German. Yeah, that's right. The reason why we went for this particular combination was because priming effects have been observed to be slightly larger, numerically speaking, from L1 to L2 when compared to L2 to L1 priming. So it would be an idea to just take Brannigan's materials and do this stuff again, yeah. That's right.
Yeah, this is just related follow-up. Is there nothing in your filler set that would allow you to show some priming, some structural priming of some sort in the case where you get the null result? I mean, given you were also worried about the between subject design in the Brannigan company stuff.
Basically, the first thing I'd like to point out is that it's not a complete null effect. When we look at the main clause condition, we get a structural priming effect that is actually numerically as large as in the within priming experiment. That also shows that neither the prime or the target as such are sort of bad primes or bad targets. If you take these two conditions and do a statistical cross-experiment comparison, you actually get these interactions significant. So it's not a null effect in this condition. It's a significant interaction between two conditions. So,